3, 2, 1. All right, guys. Today, another fantastic guest. You've met her husband, Brett Weinstein. I think I was at one point saying Weinstein. It's Weinstein. Is that correct?
No, it's Weinstein.
Oh, actually. It's Weinstein. So maybe I was saying the opposite. I can't remember which one I was saying.
It is Weinstein. No relation to the Harvey Weinstein.
I think we might get into some of that territory later, because earlier today, in preparation for our chat, I had perused it in the past, but I fully read your Toxic Femininity article. Mm-hmm. And so I thought we'll go there. So today I have Heather Hying with us, who is an evolutionary biologist from a former place, Evergreen State College. Did I get that right?
It is the Evergreen State College. It still exists.
I don't
know how long it'll exist.
But. Your official title now is Professor in Exile.
Yes, self-inflicted title, I guess.
Right. So I thought maybe I know you're probably very very tired of talking about, you know, what transpired, but some people might not know about it. Is it possible to maybe, this won't be the point of our chat today, but can you maybe just summarize it in 5 minutes so that people can catch up who don't know about the story?
I dread this question, as you can imagine, because it's really a years long process. The Evergreen State College was an extraordinary public liberal arts college with a unique pedagogical model, a unique educational model, at which Brett Weinstein, my husband, whom you've had on, as you mentioned, and I taught for him for 14, me for 15 years. With a change in administration came a president who was interested in signing up with, call them what you like, the grievance scholars, perhaps, a la Peter Boghossian, James Lindsay, and Helen Pluckrose's recent project. The intersectionalists, to use their own terms, post-structuralists, post-moderns, all of this.
Or as I call them, the intellectual terrorists, but yeah, go on.
Also apt, yes, for sure. So he signed up with them for reasons that are not clear, and effectively ran roughshod over a system that had been quite capable of educating a diverse, particularly a socioeconomically diverse student body, really deeply, richly, broadly. And there were things ramped up over the 2016-17 academic year, culminating in protests showing up at Brett's classroom on May 23rd of 2017. Most of the students there, neither he nor I knew any of them, but most of them there apparently had been sent by another provocateur on campus, an activist. They didn't even know why they were there. They famously now chanted for his resignation. He stood firm. He asked for not just dialogue, but dialectic as opposed to debate. And they made one of many both strategic and tactical errors when they then uploaded the video that they took then and later in the day in private conversations, previously private conversations with admin. And then throughout the week, the increasingly aggressive and violent protests to first Facebook, and then someone grabbed them from Facebook and put them on YouTube, we don't know who, and they went viral because it really was a remarkable sort of, you know, in some ways the platonic ideal of what is going on with regard to campus protests. And I use protest advisedly and not really feeling like it's a protest in the traditional sense. And maybe that's weird to talk about a traditional protest, but I mean, I think you can grok what I mean there, that, you know, protest is good faith, and there are ways that systems that can go bad such that protest is necessary. And it certainly at Evergreen, about which I know, unfortunately, you know, nearly all of the details probably, and at each of the other ones of these modern instantiations, of which I know less, of course, the protests do not appear to be good faith. The initial objections are mostly founded on nothing. For instance, with regard to Evergreen, the complaint was supposedly that there was systemic racism on campus. And when Brett and I and a small handful of other faculty, mostly emeritus, requested evidence of systemic racism at Evergreen, none was forthcoming. So the
Well,
entire-
actually, you asking for it was a manifestation of racism.
Yes, indeed, it is, because we were asking the people who were making the claims to do emotional labor on our behalf. Right. So I think your term is right. It is a kind of intellectual terrorism. And there are a few of us standing up and saying, this is actually going to be the death of the Academy.
Right.
And when you do what you do, and when we did what we did and are continuing to do so, and Peter and Lindsay and Helen and the Christakises and Jonathan Haidt and Joe Rogan and Sam Harris and Dave Rubin are creating podcasts where they're willing and in some cases eager to talk about what is actually happening as opposed to what we are being told we're allowed to talk about, we are allowing millions, and I believe probably tens of millions, perhaps hundreds of millions, that may be too much, of people to see honest conversation and to say, okay, you know what? I wasn't going crazy. This wasn't me. I was censored. I was self-censoring. I was observing as other people were being censored. And as interesting, valuable, perhaps true, perhaps untrue, but we have to investigate them, ideas are being driven underground.
Does it surprise you, since you spoke about sort of the large platforms that are now popping up everywhere to discuss ideas outside of the academy, does it surprise you that so few professors, I mean, there's an increasing number now, but it still remains a very small percentage of the overall population of professors who are taking advantage of these tools to spread ideas, to discuss ideas? Does that surprise you?
Not really. And this speaks to perhaps my lack of faith in the professoriate. And that didn't show up on May 23rd of 2017 when the protests at Evergreen became public. And nor do I think that it was just the Evergreen bubble wherein I was increasingly disenchanted with the willingness of faculty to seek truth and to be courageous. I think it's a problem across faculty, across the Western world, across weird countries, as far as I can tell.
I think Brett and I might have touched on this, if I'm not mistaken, but we spoke sort of about, I think it was him, and if it isn't, it's one of my chats, I can't remember who it might have been, sort of that academia might, there's kind of a self-selection bias whereby you don't typically get the super courageous, sort of brawny, non-coward. And maybe it's a stereotype, but do you think that, I mean, is there something unique about academics that makes them more prone to fall victim to cowardice? Or are they just representative of the scourge of cowardice that inflicts most humans?
Certainly the latter, right? That in some ways they and we are no different from any other population. But has the signal been boosted some in faculty? Is there a selection force for cowardice? Maybe, are meek liberals more likely to be represented among the faculty than in other professions? Well, we know for sure that there's a left-wing bias among faculty. That's well established. I don't think, though, that on average, people on the left side of the political spectrum are more cowardly or more meek than people on the right side of the political spectrum. I don't think that follows ideological lines. But I would say that, like in any profession, people want to keep their heads down until the thing actually shows up at their door.
Right.
And so I don't think it's any accident that many of the people who are speaking up are trained in some form of evolutionary thinking.
Right.
Like this does not feel like an accident at all. And, in fact, I wrote this in a Wall Street Journal op-ed over a year ago it's a little bit tongue-in-cheek. First, they came to the biologists.
Yeah.
But not entirely. That those of us who, I don't know about you, actually, I'd be curious to know, but certainly in my classrooms, in Brett's classrooms, we were teaching evolutionary biology. We were teaching sexual selection and the evolution of territoriality and hierarchies and parental care and all of these things to greatly enthusiastic and rigorous and students who would talk back and not trust us based on our authority, but we created community and we were able to go deep with these ideas. That is what you do with an evolutionary understanding of the universe, is you don't let any idea stand just because someone that you think is an authority said it, right? So I don't think that the intellectual terrorists, the grievance scholars, whatever you want to call them, are seeking us out per se, but it is our nature to see patterns and speak about them when, especially when nonsense starts to be spouted. You know, when dogma about, you know, men and women are a social construct begins to show up places, we are much more likely than, say, you know, even, you know, so I'm trained as a biologist for my PhD, you know, my would-be peers in, you know, so within biology, we have sort of skin out, whole organism, and bigger, and skin in. That's one way to characterize the division. So the skin in biologists, the people who are looking at, you know, organs or organelles or cells or molecules, are much less likely to actually have an opinion about male versus female, and are therefore much more likely to sort of shut their lab door and say, this isn't about me, this doesn't concern me, let me do my work, I'm gonna collect my grants, I'm gonna be the PI that I need to be on these papers that I'm working on, and that madness will hopefully be self-contained.
Right.
And I think, you know, you and I and many others are looking around going, it's patently not self-contained, and furthermore, it's batshit crazy.
Right. I mean, to pick up on your point about why is it that evolutionary thinkers are likely to be involved in the battle. I mean, definitely the content of evolutionary theory is going to trigger my resistance to having to prove that there is such a thing as male and female in front of the Canadian Senate. But I think more generally, evolutionary theory promotes consilience. It promotes synthetic thinking. And therefore, I'm able, and I think I can speak for many of the people that you mentioned, if not all of them, because of this penchant for synthetic thinking, I'm able to see patterns that otherwise many other people might not have put together, right? So I see the stress or the threat of forbidden knowledge when it comes to trying to Darwinize the business school. So then I see, I have an uh-oh moment there. Then I see people who get upset if you use the word retard on Twitter. That's another uh-oh moment. Well, someone else might have seen these as being completely different instantiations of phenomena that are not related. But once you start seeing many of these patterns, you're able to put it together. So I wonder if that also might not explain the fact that we are trained, if not we're drawn to evolutionary theory, because we like to achieve consilience. And that allows us to then see patterns that many other people will miss. Could that be a possible explanation?
Absolutely. There's an initial conditions question with regard to cause and effect.
Right.
So, you know, perhaps the observation is true that those trained in evolutionary thinking are more likely to be in the crosshairs of this thing. If so, why? Well, once whichever initial condition it was, either evolutionary thinking gave right. those of us insight into, or we were already interested and so found evolutionary thinking as a way into thinking this way, and then it's kind of a step function or
right.
a step ladder up to getting more and more into it. And I would say just one thing in what you just said that struck me. I think you used the phrase Darwinize the business school.
Right.
You know, even that language, which, you know, I know what you mean, right? But most people who are not thinking explicitly evolutionarily are going to say, "Ah, see, that is what evolution is about. You know, that is it is about the rough and tumble nastiness
right.
of abject territoriality." It's right. like, well, yes, but and right. it is also about cooperation and systems that come together and become emergent due to forces that aren't inherently nasty, right? So it's both things. And so when we, you know, social Darwinism is not the same thing as Darwinism, and yet we use these words correctly, but it confuses people.
Yeah, absolutely. I'll leave the evergreen story in a second, but just to sort of close the parenthesis on it, now I guess more than a year removed from the debacle, is there anything about what transpired that you regret? For example, you are a professor in exile. Would you, if you could look backward, would you say, you know, I wish I still had my nice, beautiful life in Washington and so on? Or on the contrary, you lived out your convictions and it only allowed you to sort of double down in your convictions that this is a fight that must be fought?
Certainly, both Brett and I have some heartache, some heartbreak over what happened. We really did love the school and continued to believe in the educational model that was there at the beginning almost 50 years ago. But I certainly, given that that is what was going on at the school, and clearly from what continues to come out of it, continues to go on. I mean, just this week, in a end of the quarter faculty meeting, which was guaranteed to attract only the true believers, the faculty voted to get rid of the word covenant from the college because it might offend some Native American tribes. Yeah. Covenant was a word that was used for the agreements between faculty and students that was really quite a, the word had religious overtones for sure, as did so many of the words that were used at Evergreen. I always thought of it as sounding much more Christian than as potentially being offensive to Native Americans. But, that's what's happening at that school right now. In a year when incoming freshmen were down, I think it's 40%, 40% this year from last year. And it was already down a lot last year because of what had happened in the spring of 2017. So
zero learning, basically.
Zero learning.
Wow. Yeah.
And I was up there a couple weeks ago on campus. I gave a talk on campus. It was, it was the first time I'd been on campus in any professional capacity since the spring of 2017, even though we lived across the street for over a year after the protests. I've only recently moved. But Mike Peros, who is the most vocal other faculty member at Evergreen, who repeatedly spoke up for truth and actual justice and fairness, is teaching, or I guess just finished teaching, a program on basically viewpoint diversity and the need for it on college campuses. Much to the chagrin of the administration, they tried to shut it down, but he made it happen. And so this quarter, he's had a number of people. I mean, he had Peter Boghossian Skyped in. I believe Jonathan Haidt did. A number of people have been part of this. And he had me come up and talk to the students for 3 hours on campus. And I have to say, the comparison between walking through campus, feeling like this place used to be my home, and it's simply hostile now.
Right.
And getting into the classroom with students I've never met before, but I immediately knew what to do. They're wonderful. The Evergreen students are actually wonderful. The vast majority of them are. Perhaps some of them are easily indoctrinated, like all 18 to 25-year-olds, right? And these students were smart and interested in difficult conversations. And we spent almost 3 hours talking about a little bit about what had happened in Evergreen, but more to the point about what we can do at a societal level to move forward, and what individuals can do to create value in the world while also giving themselves whatever degree of security they think they need. And that's what we talked about. It was wonderful. So, being back on that campus just a couple of weeks ago reminded me of both what was wonderful about it and how far it's fallen.
So what's next for both of you now? And here I had asked you offline whether I can pose the following sort of delicate question. Let me contextualize it in the following way. So typically, professors can potentially find a job elsewhere, although, as I found out, despite the fact that I have a pretty sizable CV, the more senior you become, maybe paradoxically, the more difficult it becomes to move, because you have a lot of baggage. There are a lot of people who don't like what you do, who disagree with it, or they're not looking for someone with your specific areas of expertise. So notwithstanding that you might have a very accomplished dossier, it's not very easy to move. And so it is really true that tenure is a form of golden handcuffs. Now, in your case, in looking at both you and Brett, you obviously come from very solid training, both PhDs from University of Michigan, top university in general, and certainly in evolutionary thinking. Yet you didn't pursue sort of the 10 papers a year, manufacturing system. You both had maybe a couple of early papers and then not much after that. Is that because at your school, you were very much at a teaching university that did not necessarily reward or give you the opportunities for research, so you became much more of a teacher rather than a researcher? Or was it a choice that you yourself made? And if so, is this going to make it difficult for you to go to another academic job, since you may not have the right dossier at this point?
Yeah, well, those are good questions. I think it was both a choice that we made because we were interested to be at Evergreen. I was lucky enough to have a choice of job offers back when I took the job at Evergreen. which you know, is a vanishingly rare experience these days. And both of them were at liberal arts colleges, Evergreen being public and the other one being private. And I ended up choosing Evergreen for two broad reasons. And one of them was being public was more attractive to me, that I would get to teach students that were socioeconomically diverse and not just students who had always known they were going to college and it was gifted to them by their parents. And so they weren't challenged particularly by the reality of being there. But the model was clearly a full-time teaching model. And while Evergreen, you know, earlier, actually, it did discourage research. It didn't actively discourage research. But if you threw yourself into your teaching, as I did, as Brett did, what we did was developed ideas in classrooms and with, you know, with students, effectively ran graduate level seminars in evolutionary thinking year after year after year with communities of students who became like graduate students. So, you know, could we have, I don't even want to say should we have, could we have published more? Sure, we could have, but it didn't seem, it both didn't seem necessary. And we also, I specifically, in my interview actually at Evergreen, was asked, when do you expect to write your first NSF grant? You know, being in the US, NSF being the sure. big grant getting agency. And I, much to my shock and horror at the time, said without editing, oh, I don't intend to play that game. Well, you know, I'm not going to get this job, am
right?
I? And you know,
so your trajectory was pretty much anchored at that point.
yeah, and you know, I did certainly look into that game a bit and decided it didn't feel like the way to actually maintain freedom of inquiry. So, you know, much like the intersectionalists, the grievance scholars are tamping down on actual inquiry, especially in the sciences, but across the humanities and social sciences as well. The academic model of least publishable unit and adding more and more authors to your paper, such that in some cases, I mean, I've known people who were proud of the fact that they wrote a paragraph in a paper and didn't even read the rest of the paper, such that when I would ask them about, oh, you know, what is this finding me? It's like, oh, I don't know.
Yeah.
Your name's on the paper. Well, I, yeah,
you
know, it's
that's not, a major it's problem. And, you know, it's funny, if I may interrupt you, I never, ever play that game to my detriment, because I refuse to be a careerist in that sense. And many, many years ago, my mother had said to me, you know, Gad, you can't live in your purity bubble because the world doesn't abide by your purity bubble. And recently I was having a chat with my wife. And I said, you know, I sometimes feel that my honesty is truly maladaptive, because I would have had tons more papers if not to me, that sort of putting your name when you haven't done anything is scamming. But even less, even collaborations that are, you know, fully appropriate collaborations, I oftentimes will hesitate to do it, because I always think that my standards of checking everything and making sure everything is right is going to be higher than any collaborator I'm working with. Well, what if they are not as assiduous as I am? And so I feel that both my honesty and my, frankly, maladaptive perfectionism has, despite the fact that I have a, if I may say, a pretty sizable CV, it would have been double did I not suffer from those afflictions. So I hear your concern.
I think that's right. And so Dick Alexander, who recently died, was one of the you know, really one of the giant names in evolutionary biology in the mostly the late 20th century, but to some degree the early 21st as well. He was my informal advisor at Michigan and Brett's formal advisor. Was not as famous, never got the fame that he deserved, right. Even though by many measures he was perhaps the most important contributor to an understanding of human evolution,
right?
Like human evolution, social behavior, and, you know, in addition to working on singing insects and horses and, you know, all sorts of other systems. But he specifically, he was a purist and honorable down, you know, to every last inch of his body, and not only refused to sign up for collaborations that didn't quite feel right, but refused to ever put his name on his students' papers. Mm-hmm. Even when, you know, that is pretty standard, right? Mm-hmm. That advisors put their names on their students' papers, and he wouldn't do it. And so, you know, his work stands alone, his students' work stands alone, and it's extraordinary. And I think in part as a result, at the point that he died, many of his former students came together in discussion to figure out how to get an obituary into, for instance, the New York Times.
Right.
And we couldn't do it because he doesn't have the kind of reputation that someone who produced more and more and more
right.
would have.
Just to clarify what you said for the folks who may not be academics, I think what you were referring to, Heather, is where supervisors presume that simply by virtue of being supervisors, they're entitled to put their names on papers of students on which they haven't contributed anything worthy of an authorship. And that's absolutely correct. And Alexander is right to have done so. But of course, there are other cases where professors and their students collaborate properly, and we would expect them to be co-authoring papers, right? So just I just want to make that distinction. But you're absolutely, I mean, there are cases where lab directors, as you said, never mind they can't tell what paragraph, one paragraph, they couldn't tell you a single sentence, but by virtue of being a lab director, anything that comes out of there gets your name on it. That's a huge scam. I agree with you. Okay, so let's go back to the start of your career just to talk about your book that many people may not know that you've written. I think it was 2002. It seems like an interesting book. I'm certainly interested in reading it, about your experiences in the field in Madagascar, such an exotic sounding place. And then we could move on to some of the contemporary issues that are probably keeping us both up at night. The book is titled Antipode. And I asked you to tell me if I was pronouncing it properly. I hope I didn't butcher it too much. That stemmed from your field research for your PhD, correct?
That's right.
So tell us about the book. Tell us about Madagascar. Tell us about some of the cool stuff that happened while you were there.
Yeah, well, so Madagascar is the fourth largest island in the world, which given Mercator projections, you don't tend to think of it that way because it's near the equator and so looks quite a bit smaller than it actually is. It's just off the east coast of Africa, but has very much less in common with Africa than you might imagine. So biogeographically and culturally, it's more closely related to sort of India and South America, actually, sort of Gondwanan land masses. So I went there, the soundbite is I went there to study the sex lives of poison frogs.
Right.
And I started going, actually, Brett and I went there as our graduation trip from college that, as many parents do, they said, okay, we're going to give you this trip. Maybe you'll go to Europe and we're going to Madagascar.
I'm interested to know why that particular species, as someone who studies psychology, decision-making, let's drill down on that decision. There are 2 million species that one could have studied. Why that one?
Absolutely. We'd been in Madagascar for this trip, and we're starting graduate school right after that, not imagining that we'd ever go back to Madagascar. And my first couple of field seasons as a graduate student, I went to Costa Rica and thought, actually, based on an observation I'd made, just, an anecdote, really, in Madagascar, I'd been watching lemurs eat guava. And guava is not native to was it tamarind. Lemurs were eating tamarind, and tamarind is not native to Madagascar, it's native to India. And so I thought, I'll bet that human agriculture, when present near wild primates, changes the diet of primates because they have preferences that are for the same kind of decreased secondary compounds and fruits that we have, because we're related to them. So I thought, okay, let me see if I can test this hypothesis with neotropical monkeys, with New World monkeys. Because I'd already spent some time in Latin America. It felt more like my home base, but I knew I wanted to do tropical research, and I thought I wanted to do primatology. So I went down to study, to try to figure out if I could figure, I was looking for a site where there was agriculture, but there was intact rainforest and there were monkeys, and I could do some both observational work and perhaps experiments as to dietary choice. And I couldn't find the monkeys. I looked and I looked and I looked in these forests where I was in, and for reasons that I still don't know, there happened to have been no monkeys there. I've since become very good at finding monkeys. There just weren't any in these forests. But I spent every day for a field season looking for monkeys out in the rainforest, and what I did find were poison frogs. Now, this is not Madagascar, this is Latin America. So these were dart poison frogs, poison dart frogs, variously called. And I happened into a natural experiment where an ecotourist lodge, a so-called ecotourist lodge, had introduced a new species of dart poison frog because they were bigger and brighter and easier for the gringos to see.
Oh,
Yeah.
this is in
And
Costa Rica.
this was in Costa Rica.
You
This
know,
was in
I've
19.
been on an ecotourism trip in Costa Rica, and I'll talk about it after you finish your story. Go ahead.
Yeah. So I ended up basically going down this rabbit hole of, okay, ecotourism is not what it seems. Ecotourist lodges are often actually doing a tremendous amount of damage, obviously to habitat, but also to the just even the native biodiversity. Like they literally imported this species of frog, which was from the other side of the Cordillera, the other side of the mountain range. And my observation that prompted the hypothesis that I then worked on in Latin America for a year and a season and a half was the introduced frog is actually outcompeting the native frog and is driving the native poison dart frog locally extinct. Sure enough, it was. And the work that I did demonstrated that that the native frog actually called less in the presence of the introduced frog. And calling is, as you're well aware, it's the advertisement call, both to say, it's only the guys, it's only the males who do it. And the males call to say, stay away if you're male and come hither if you're female. And so if you're calling less in the presence of this, big bad introduced species, you are far less likely to get mates and you're more likely to get trounced by other males. And sure enough, they were retreating in the face of this sort of onslaught of this introduced species. So why didn't I keep working on them? After having become interested in the social behavior of frogs, which I hadn't particularly been focused on before, I thought, well, the poison dart frogs of the New World are a big, diverse phylogenetic group about whom many people have done extraordinary work. And so if I continue to work on them, I may, if I do good work, add another brick to the wall of the scientific understanding that is the evolution of social behavior in poison dart frogs in the New World. Or, hey, Madagascar just opened up. Like it was behind basically in the late 60s, they kicked out the French and they closed down the borders for until the early 90s, late 80s, early 90s, became kind of ish a socialist government. And in the early 90s, they just opened up their borders. And something like over 95% of the species in Madagascar, of the herps, the amphibians, reptiles, are endemic or found nowhere else on the planet. And no one else had done work there. No one had ever done social behavior on reptiles or amphibians there. There were, of course, some studies of lemurs, the lemurs of which are in Madagascar as well, but not very many. And so I thought, well, I could go to Madagascar, which is a hell of a lot harder to be in. It's just a lot harder to work in because it's not used to scientists being in its borders, and it's extraordinarily poor. And so, there's many fewer resources available. But anything I find is going to be new, and I get to help build the wall. That's a terrible phrase. I get to help build the foundation of the science that is going to tell us what, we're going to, I get to reveal what it is that those frogs are doing from the beginning, as opposed to in the New World, okay, we really pretty much know what these frogs are and what they're doing, and we can add little bits here and there. And they were similar enough, the New World poison frogs and the Malagasy poison frogs, that early on in the late 1800s, they'd actually been classified as sister taxa. But it was clear, it's clear now, and it was clear the point I was doing my research, that they weren't sister taxa, but that beyond that, basically no one knew what was going on. So I headed off to Madagascar to first do site scouting and find, places where I could pitch my tent, and then to go and figure out what the hell these frogs were doing.
Well, I discuss aposomatic coloring, which obviously is something that you're very intimately familiar with, in my first book, when I'm discussing deceptive signaling and how some species will mimic aposomatic coloring to appear as though they're as dangerous and so on. And I then link that to deceptive signaling in the consumer context. But more recently, actually, when I held my chat with your husband, Brett, when I first, when we, I first turned on the camera, I was wearing a red wig
I
as
remember
a,
this.
right? And I've actually, in one of my Sad Truth clips, I've somewhat facetiously, but maybe not, have argued that the reason why so many social justice warriors have colored hair is it's because it's a form of aposomatic coloring to show that, hey, don't mess with me, I'm fierce. What do you think of this theory, Dr. Evolutionary Biologist?
I think it's hilarious. It's definitely a signal for sure, right? There's no doubt there's it's a signal. And I mean, this is one of the places where you run afoul of social justice thinking, right? We say it's a signal. They say, hey, you can't tell us that. Like, you're communicating.
Right.
It's a signal. I may be wrong about what it means, but your sense of what you think it means is not necessarily what it means. And that's where, you know, that's deceit and self-deception for you, right? So is it a signal? I'm a badass and you better stay away. Could be.
I'm on to something. Yeah. Now, in I don't know if it was in your, I think it was in your Toxic Femininity article published in Quillette, where you recounted an anecdote of a beautiful, scantily clad woman who was upset that all the men, you know, were staring at her in the forest. Was that in Costa Rica or was that in Madagascar?
That was in Ecuador.
Actually. That was Ecuador. Okay, that was somewhere else. Okay. Maybe you could recount that story, because, of course, you're going to be attacked by a lot of radical feminists for arguing that she's asking for it.
Right, right. Was she, in fact, asking to be looked at by walking around almost naked among the Warani, who are an Amazonian tribe who rarely see white people, and when we do come, we are expected to be respectful? Was she asking to be looked at? Yeah. Right. Yeah, that's what she was signaling.
And I think you had communicated that to her, and she was quite indignant by your response, right?
Yeah. So let me, the story is, I was leading, and this was the last, were I still at Evergreen, Brett and I would be now preparing for our next like 12-week study abroad trip in Ecuador with students and our boys. But this was in 2016, winter and spring of 2016. It was Brett and me and our two sons and 30 undergraduates, 30, wow, whom we had with us for 11 weeks on a trip that this is one of the things that I loved to do, created from scratch this itinerary, this curriculum, after we'd spent 15 weeks on campus building up evolutionary theory and animal behavior and statistics and philosophy of science. Then we go down and we spend time in the Amazon, in the Andes, at pre-Columbian sites, Galapagos. It's just, you know, it was really one of the joys of working at Evergreen, that you could do that, right? It was a year-long program, after which, boy, did those students know a lot of stuff and have a real clear sense of where they were in the world, you know, no privilege there that they hadn't investigated pretty carefully, right?
Oh, there's your dog.
Yes. In the middle of this trip, and you know, again, these are 30 students whom we had chosen carefully. We'd handpicked them. They'd have to apply to get into the program to begin with. They'd had to apply again. We'd been on domestic field trips with them already, so we knew them well, including this, you know, extremely smart, extremely beautiful student, who from the very beginning of the trip was not wearing enough clothes. And this was consistent from her demeanor back in the US. It was, she didn't need to do that to get the attention of men, but it certainly increased the attention that she got. And she was really deeply confused about who was supposed to change if she didn't want to have eyes on her. And I guess I would say, so she was wearing a bikini in the Amazon when all the rest of us are in sort of asexualizing, grubby field gear, you know, rubber boots, you know, formless shirts, all of this. And the Warani men were indeed looking at her. Of course they were. No one touched her. No one even approached her to make a comment that she might have thought was inappropriate. And certainly nothing obscene was said even. And no actions happened, but they were looking at her. And she approached me to complain about them, about what they were doing.
Well, I mean, she probably comes from the school of thought that basically says that the male gaze is a form of visual rape. And if you push that logic further, this is why the burqa is liberating, because it averts the male gaze, whereas the bikini is a tool of the patriarchal oppressive system, right? And so if she's taken a course in that, then it would make perfect sense that she would come to you with exactly the position that she's come to you with, right?
Yeah, I think so. And you know, I don't think this particular woman had taken any of the gender ideology courses, but maybe this points to how pervasive it is,
right?
Exactly. Right, that it's just it's practically in the water now.
Yeah,
right. That she, yeah, and you know, I'm not in touch with her now. But if she showed up on my radar, you know, we're friendly. You know, we're good.
Right.
She didn't like when I said to her, you're going to have to put on more clothes.
Right.
Like that's what's going to change here. And then, you know, either that, which I've already asked you to do because it's respectful, because we're here in their home, we're guests in these people's home and homeland, and you're not dressed appropriately. But certainly if you're coming here to ask me to ask them to change their behavior, I'm not going to do that. Now,
so what happened? Did she change? Did she change the sartorial choices?
Not much.
Not much.
You know, it was made more complicated by the fact that there was on that same trip, in a totally different place, someone with whom we were affiliating as a program briefly, who was making inappropriate comments, and you know, was creeping out some of the girls in a legitimately. And in that case, both Brett and I went and talked to him and told him that he needed to cease and desist, or we were going to have to separate the course from him. And again, there was no touching. There was, you know, there was nothing actually that went even close to criminal. But it was, you know, there's nuance here.
Right.
You know, do men sometimes act in abhorrent ways? Yes. And you know, where's the line there? Well, we're not all fall on that same line. You know, we're going to have different estimations of where it is that creepy goes over into you can't do that.
Do you think that I often ask this question in different contexts, because it always fascinates me to know when people behave in certain ways, whether in the deep recesses of their mind, they're self-deceiving about the veracity, they're engaging in self-deception about the veracity of their positions. So I often ask people, for example, do the postmodernists truly believe their bullshit in the deep recesses of their mind when they go to bed at night?
Yep.
And so let me ask you this similar type of question for this woman, which applies to, you know, more generally this type of sort of denialism. Do you think in the deep recesses of her mind she actually knew that she was full of it, that she was it just her attempt to sort of signal victimology, but she truly, or do you truly think that her compass was so confused that she didn't know which way was up or down?
Boy, in her case, I'm not sure. And I think and maybe this points to why we've gotten where we've gotten at a sort of a social level, where it's easier to point to a group and say they think this way, and I'm hesitating here and going, well, I'm not sure, because I know this woman, and like I said, I'm not in contact with her right now, but I'm imagining her now, and she is smart and super capable and, you know, super creative, and boy, is she undermining her credibility with the way she dresses. She is. And I think the first person to ever say that to her, and it struck her as appalling that what she imagined, you know, her actual, like, you know, second waiver before sort of feminist professor, not that I ever, you know, I don't wear that as a mantle, I just sort of be a person that I would like to be in the world, and young women can say, oh yeah, you can do that and not be wearing the shield of victimhood. She was legitimately shocked by my response, but she did take it under advisement without changing her behavior right then. On the other hand, most of us, when we've learned something, don't change our behavior right then.
Right.
So I'm not sure.
Right. We talked about your debacle. We talked a bit about your early work and your field work. Have you been back to Madagascar, by the way?
Not since 1999. It's been a while.
It's been a while.
Yeah,
almost 20 years.
I spent several field seasons there.
Got it. So now, as a professor in exile, you're weighing in a lot more in sort of the arena of public ideas and trying to lend your voice to some of these issues. You wrote this fantastic article. As I said, I read it fully earlier today in preparation for our chat, the toxic femininity article. It'd be great if you give us, I was planning on actually reading a few of the passages that I thought were fantastic, but might as well just let you sort of summarize them. I think what's wonderful about having precisely a woman do this, because if I were to say the exact same thing based on identity, politics, calculus, it wouldn't somehow carry as much weight and force than if a woman says them. So maybe you could give us a quick summary of that article.
Yeah, well, you've read it more recently than I have, so so you might do a better job than I do. But of course, I am about to demonstrate my own internalized misogyny.
Ah, there you go.
Right. The idea basically is, so toxic masculinity is a phrase that I abhor, and I think that toxic femininity should go the same, you know, should be disappeared like toxic masculinity should be disappeared. But if we're going to talk about the one, then we need to talk about the other. And so, you know, a number of points, but toxic masculinity, you know, is there some way that traits that are on average more male than female can go rogue and can actually cause problems in the world? Of course, like right. obviously, right? That germ of truth, which is, you know, you could say that about so much in the postmodernist, post-structuralist canon, right? There's like a germ of truth. It started with something real and then it became this like hideous pearl,
right?
That too many people are now expanding that germ into, okay, well then masculinity is toxic, like reversing the order of expectation, or when masculinity goes toxic, that's the exception, as opposed to now we have a lot of people, including, what was it, the Washington Post, who published, like, can we hate all men?
Right.
So, I mean, this, people will say, oh, it's not very common. Oh, you're exaggerating. No. This idea that masculinity itself is toxic is taking hold. So that's wrong and dangerous, one. But as to the original observation, can masculinity go toxic? Sure. Okay, so what does it look like when femininity goes toxic? What are the ways that traits that are sort of on average more female than male can be taken to an extent or used in contexts where it's actually bad for society, bad for people? And, you know, that goes a number of ways, but one of them, frankly, we see, I guess I don't think I did this in the piece, but we see in how the Me Too movement has played out.
Right.
Me Too, I honestly don't know how it started. I want to believe that it started with the best intentions, and it really could have been an honorable reckoning in which the vast majority of men who do not treat women badly come to understand that that doesn't change the fact that the vast majority of women, maybe even every woman, right? But at least the vast majority of women, when they're young, are harassed to some degree on the basis of being young women. That truth has almost disappeared under the believe all women hashtag, right. which is nonsense. Believe all X. I don't care what X is. No, I won't. Right. That's authoritarian nonsense. And it's a totally gameable system. And this, again, is, you know, a place where having some training in evolutionary biology, thinking about game theory, is that or is that not a gameable system? That's a gameable system. Ah, look, there it was. It was gamed. Believe all women shows up. And now we have people making false claims and saying things like, men, it's okay if some innocent men go down as long as victims are listened to.
Exactly.
No, actually, it's not. That's anti-democratic.
So right? then can I then assume that you were as appalled by the treatment of Brett Kavanaugh as I was? Because some of the people in our common circles did not seem to see it the way you seem to be speaking now, and certainly the way that I enunciated the position on Brett Kavanaugh, where I thought it was absolutely appalling how he was being treated. But people that we both know who are supposedly high IQ people were completely naturally lobotomized when it came to Brett Kavanaugh. So what are your thoughts on that?
Well, you may find me naturally lobotomized on this point, then.
Uh-oh.
So this will be interesting. I mean, I think we're just on a podcast, right? I can say that was a clusterfuck. that's what that was. The mob should not have voice. The mob should not be given the ability to decide the fate of the Supreme Court of the United States. That is true, for sure. Put aside whether or not you believe her or believe him. There was plenty of evidence not stemming from her testimony, for instance, in the book that his buddy wrote, Judge, I guess, that I skimmed, that I read part of, because I actually was really drawn into this. I couldn't think about anything else for a little while. I happened to be in D.C. just as it was breaking, meeting with some people. I talked to the DOJ, and it was just beginning to happen. So there were these murmurs around it. And at first I thought, oh, well, this her complaint is incredible. But then reading what contemporary friends of his had said, I thought, boy, I'm really not happy about this, but I'm confident that I knew that guy. I know I didn't know him, but there is a type, and I wouldn't have wanted to be anywhere near him when I was, we're similar enough in age, when we were both in high school, or when he was in college and I was in high school. That doesn't change the fact the mob shouldn't have had a say, but that, well, it's been a while since I've thought about this, but
I was
killed by him. What's that?
Yeah, I was going to say that some of the folks in our common circle argued, well, it's not a criminal case, so the presumption of innocence doesn't apply as much. That has to be one of the most idiotic and offensive statements I've ever heard from a functioning brain. So from now on, what I'm going to do when someone comes for a professorship, I'm going to accuse them on innuendo from 36 years ago that they are sadistic, sexual, pedophilic cannibals to see how they respond. And if they don't respond in a way that is professorial, that suggests to me that they don't have the emotional restraint to be professors, because, bruh, it's not a criminal trial. It's just a interview for a professorship. So it's difficult for me to reconcile how someone who I consider to be a friend, who can say many intelligent things, can actually hold this position. And my explanation for this is it demonstrates that the terminal affliction of ostrich parasitic syndrome that I will be discussing in great detail in my forthcoming book, yes, shameless plug, it's my show, can afflict anybody at any time, at any place. It's not restricted to the left. It's not restricted to the right. It doesn't only attack idiotic people. It can actually inflict and parasitize minds that are otherwise quite sophisticated. What do you think of this very damning statement?